Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The World Bank considers how to help nations deal with Ebola. The violence continues in the Central African Republic. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. A top U.S. health official says Ebola is the biggest world health crisis since HIV/AIDS. Dr. Thomas Frieden spoke today at World Bank headquarters in Washington during a meeting on the Ebola outbreak that has crippled three West African nations and has been detected in several other countries. Frieden of the Centers for Disease Control predicted the fight to wipe out the disease will be a long one because the virus keeps changing. He said the only outbreak he has seen resembling the current one is AIDS, and added that the world community must work hard so this is not the next AIDS. The Associated Press is reporting many casualties in Bangui, the capital of the Central African Republic, following the worst violence there since the United Nations peacekeepers arrived last month. The aid agency, Doctors Without Borders, says its staff stayed home today. Red Cross officials report their workers were threatened as they tried to recover victims' bodies. Reports from the CAR say fighting erupted following an incident Wednesday in which a former Muslim fighter was killed by Christian militia forces. According to a report by the Reuters news agency, the South African government is initiating a program to improve living conditions in mining communities. The government has earmarked $190 million over 3 years to upgrade housing in poor mining communities. Recent labor unrest in the mining industry has been blamed in part on poor living conditions in the shanty towns that spring up around the mines. This is VOA News. The AFP News Service reports that the trial of Shren Dawane, the businessman on trial in South Africa for allegedly hiring a hitman to kill his wife, has adjourned for the day. Both Dawane and the prosecution and a prosecution witness said they were sick, and the trial has been delayed. The AFP reports that Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan is threatening legal action against a website that claimed the president has a fortune worth about $100 million. Mr. Jonathan called the implication that he had corruptly enriched himself in office baseless and libelous. The United States military says Kurdish militias in Kobani remain in control of most of the city along the Syrian-Turkey border. The assessment comes amid intensified U.S.-led airstrikes on IS targets in and around the Syrian city, amid fears that it could soon fall to the militants. Kobani's defense chief says the Kurdish People's Protection Units, known as the YPG, held off the militant group in fierce fighting overnight. For more on this story, visit our website, voanews.com. Student leaders of the Hong Kong pro-democracy protest movement have called on supporters to continue occupying public spaces. The call came just hours after the government called off talks with the protesters. The discussions were meant to ease weeks of tensions in the semi-autonomous Chinese territory. Alex Chow of the Hong Kong Federation of Students on Thursday blamed the government for the stall in negotiations, saying the students had not done anything to provoke the action. French novelist Patrick Modiano has won the 2014 Nobel Prize in Literature. Peter Englund, permanent secretary for the Swedish Academy, made the announcement.
The Nobel Prize in Literature for the year 2014 is awarded to the French author Patrick Modiano for the art of memory, which he has evoked the most ungraspable human destinies and uncovered the life world of the occupation.
Modiano's writing often focused on life under German occupation in World War II France. A suicide bomber has killed at least 42 people in Yemen's capital. The attack apparently targeted an anti-government demonstration led by Shiite Houthi rebels. The bombing today occurred in the Tahrir Square section of central Sana'a, which the rebels have controlled since last month. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. Meanwhile, in southern Yemen, a suicide car bombing there killed at least 20 soldiers. The Houthis have staged protests for weeks. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
La fièvre Ebola est extrêmement contagieuse.
He says the Ebola virus is highly contagious and so he has decided not to go close to any Sierra Leone player or member of the delegation for an interview, adding that he will watch the match from a distance.
That's a sports journalist in Cameroon who has decided to avoid visitors from Ebola-stricken countries. Details coming up. Also in the news, residents of Central African Republic's capital, Bangui, stayed off the streets for a second day of renewed clashes between armed factions. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the White House announced increased screening procedures at five major U.S. airports in an effort to identify any passengers entering the country with an Ebola infection. President Barack Obama announced the new measures at five airports, New York's John F. Kennedy, Dulles in Washington, D.C., and other international airports in Newark, New Jersey, Atlanta, Georgia, and O'Hare in Chicago, Illinois. One of the new procedures is the use of a no-touch thermometer to determine if a passenger has fever. The Ebola virus is transmitted on bodily fluids, and Ebola survivors in West Africa are being advised to remain celibate or use condoms for at least 3 months to prevent the transmission of the fatal virus through semen. The World Health Organization reports that of the several ways fluids can be transmitted to another human, the virus can survive in semen for as long as 90 days. The Ebola virus has killed more than 3,800 people in five West African countries. The presidents of the three countries where the vast majority of Ebola deaths have occurred, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, have appealed to the World Bank for more help in controlling the epidemic. On Tuesday, the World Bank predicted if the virus spreads to other African countries with substantially larger economies, the financial impact in the next 14 months would be a loss of $32 billion. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said the affected countries need more than $300 million in aid, including doctors, mobile testing labs, and food aid. Incidents of infections in West Africa are being traced to other countries. A traveler from Liberia, Thomas Eric Duncan, died yesterday at a Dallas hospital. In Spain, a nurse is being treated for an Ebola infection after she cared for a Spanish priest who was evacuated from Sierra Leone and died in a Madrid hospital. A U.S. photographer working in Liberia is now being treated at a special facility in Omaha, Nebraska. He is the fifth American, Ashoka Mupo, evacuated from West Africa to receive treatment for Ebola. All others survived. Mupo has been taking an experimental treatment for the virus and yesterday received a transfusion of blood from Dr. Kent Brantley, the first American diagnosed with the virus. Brantley recovered last month during treatment at an Atlanta hospital. Cameroon has limited the number of Sierra Leoneans traveling to its country for the African Cup of Nations football qualifier to 40, including players, in response to the Ebola scare that has hit the country. Ebola has ravaged thousands of lives. People in Cameroon have been expressing fears and stigmatizing Sierra Leoneans already in their country. The World Health Organization says nearly 3,900 people have died from the Ebola outbreak, mostly in West Africa. There are more than 8,000 confirmed cases. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Cameroon medical staff are present here at Mvogbi, a neighborhood in Yaoundé, where Sierra Leone players are lodged for the African Cup of Nations football qualifier against the Lions of Cameroon. The presence of players from Sierra Leone has scared workers of the hotel, and some, like Claire Dama, have refused to attend to clients until the visiting team leaves. She says she cannot work because she does not want to die. Sports journalist Frix Bayamak says he is frightened and has decided not to go near the visitors.
La fièvre Ebola est extrêmement contagieuse. C'est pour cette raison simple que j'ai pris la décision.
He says the Ebola virus is highly contagious, and so he has decided not to go close to any Sierra Leone player or member of the delegation for an interview, adding that he will watch the match from a distance. The scare has made Cameroon restrict the number of Sierra Leoneans coming for away and return matches of the African Cup of Nations qualifier to 40, including players. Cameroon Minister of Health, André Mamafouda, told VOA that it was one of several measures taken to keep the Ebola virus out of the country. He said the players from Sierra Leone will also be tested for Ebola throughout their stay in Cameroon.
Disinfect hands, restrict and control visits to members of the delegation, strictly forbidding visits in bedrooms. The Cameroonian medical team shall take the temperature of each member of the delegation morning and evening. Transport players and members of the Sierra Leone delegation in specific vehicles.
Elias Itat, a Cameroonian-born Sierra Leone team supporter in Cameroon, says his team is not given fair treatment. He says he was refused access to meet and cheer up the players during their training session.
On a interdit au public Sierra Leone de faire le déplacement du Cameroun, dont il n'y aura pas de supporters.
He says by refusing to allow football supporters from Sierra Leone to travel to Cameroon, Cameroon is already giving an advantage to its team, and that is not fair play. Cameroon Minister of Communication and Government spokesperson Issa Chiruma Bakari told VOA that they were not in any way stigmatizing Sierra Leone, but simply helping to stop the spread of Ebola. He calls on Cameroonians to be welcoming, but not to go close to the visitors.
All protective measures taken during the stay of the Sierra Leone football delegation in Cameroon is not intended to either stigmatize members of this delegation. The measures undertaken are intended to guarantee their health and, in the same time, prevent any unfortunate contamination to occur during their stay.
All efforts to get the reaction of members of the football delegation from Sierra Leone failed. United Nations health experts say the only way to protect the rest of the world from Ebola is to stop it in West Africa. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Israel has announced it is sending more aid to help in the fight against the deadly virus. Paul Herson, who is with the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Tel Aviv, tells VOA Susan Yagi about his nation's contributions to control Ebola.
We've already sent a medical team out some weeks ago to Sierra Leone. We sent equipment out, including to teams of the African Union. But following a number of requests that we received from various different governments, from the United Nations Secretary General and from the World Health Organization, the Foreign Ministry decided that we are going to be sending at least at this point 3 mobile medical clinics built here in Israel to the specifications of the World Health Organization for such cases. And going out with them will be medical teams. They'll be involved both in treatment and in education and in preventative healthcare approaches. I don't know that it is the biggest effort that anybody is doing. It's still at this point maybe modest, but we're doing what we can because it's the right thing to do. You know, Israel's competencies in this, which are very, very well known, Israel's at all the earthquakes and tsunamis all over the world, Israel's primary competencies are really in disaster recovery when there's an event which happens and it's over, and then there needs to be, it's more trauma medical treatment, whereas this is an ongoing developing pharmacological epidemic. So we're doing what we can, but it's not the same as issues like earthquakes where we have world-renowned competencies.
Perhaps you'll tell us a little bit about these units, what they can provide to help.
Well, I'm not a medical expert myself, so it's a little bit difficult for me to get into the details, but they'll definitely be, they'll be addressing a couple of things. They'll be addressing, of course, treatment. They'll be addressing training of local medical staff that is there in various different places, and they'll be addressing the issue of education for preventative behavior. Those are sort of the three fields of operations that they'll be in.
Are you worried about your employees that are going to be there? Are you worried for their own health?
Well, the truth is, you know, we're Israelis, we're worried about everything, so the answer is yes. But I think that the medical professionals know what they're doing when they go into these situations, and they know how to function and behave. I think when addressed correctly, the dangers are minimized. I don't want to say that they don't exist, because as we all know, they do. So the answer is yes, we're worried. We're always worried about everything. But, you know, that doesn't mean that one mustn't do the correct thing.
Now, this isn't the only project Israel has in Africa. Perhaps you tell us about some of the other projects you have going on there.
Well, we have a lot of projects in Africa, spanning decades, actually. During the course of a long period of time now, over 250,000 Africans have come to Israel for short-term courses in a whole plethora of subjects, from agriculture to healthcare, women's rights, small business management, various other topics, irrigation systems, and gone back home. We've done the same in reverse, sending trainers out to Africa, probably, I don't know the exact number, but probably reaching out to an additional 250,000 people. The goal is this, the idea is this. There are a lot of discussion that's gone on about developing countries all over the world, in this case Africa. And our feeling is that with all the issues that developing countries face, the real answer is increased investment in sustainable development. That investment is not only in financial terms, it's also in terms of human capital. Israelis are well known for being willing to roll up their sleeves and get down in difficult places. We've built a number of clinics, we've built a number of schools, and in the last few years, the trend has been to go into trilateral agreements between Israel, a specific country in one or another place in Africa, and a partner country. We've got agreements with Germany, we've got agreements with the Americans, we've got agreements with the Italians, with a couple of others where we've worked together in Africa, bringing each party, bringing their own competency. We're fairly proud of our record. We've got farms that have been built in Senegal. We've got clinics that have been built in Uganda. We have a fish farm built in Kenya. All of these are both active, whether they're farms or clinics or schools, and educational training centers.
Paul Hirshen is spokesperson for the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Tel Aviv. He was speaking to VOA's Susan Yaki. Nineteen past the hour. You were listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Residents of Central African Republic's capital, Bangui, stayed off the streets for a second day of renewed clashes between armed factions. A member of the staff of Doctors Without Borders, also known internationally as MSF, reports another day of heavy weapons fire. It's the worst violence heard on the streets of the city since a UN force arrived in the country. More than 7,000 UN peacekeepers last month joined an African Union force of 6,000 to maintain a ceasefire agreement. Shooting started Tuesday when a member of the mostly Muslim Seleka faction was killed. Mortar fire has been heard in the KM5 neighborhood of the city. One of the clashing militias has called for the resignation of interim president Catherine Samba Panza, the former mayor of Bangui. She was chosen as caretaker of the government when Seleka leader Michel Djotodia resigned under international pressure. About 5,000 people have died in 9 months of sectarian fighting. The fighting began in the former French colony when Seleka forces led by Djotodia swept into the capital and forced the departure of a serving president. The Ethiopian government has nominated 90-year-old Dr. Catherine Hamelin for this year's Nobel Peace Prize. Martha van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa, where the doctor has been running a fistula clinic for 40 years.
On a beautiful compound hidden in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, you can find the Addis Ababa Fistula Hospital. Fistula is an abnormal connection between an organ, vessel or intestine and another part of the body. The Fistula Hospital was established by Australian Dr. Catherine Hamelin and her late husband in 1974. Unlike many other hospitals, this one is not overcrowded and the facility is very well maintained. There are a total of 147 beds. In one of the rooms lies 35-year-old Rahima from Arsi, a southwestern part of Ethiopia. She gave birth to a baby 3 months ago, but labor complications led to fistula. She says that due to the labor problems, she would leak urine. It wasn't that much in the beginning, but she was ashamed and tried hiding it by staying at home for weeks. She says that when the flow increased, she went to her local hospital and was told to be treated in Addis Ababa. Rahima is not the only fistula patient. Poor access to health facilities leaves 1 in 16 women in Africa with fistula and other serious risk during pregnancy or childbirth, especially those living in rural areas. Fistula is caused due to prolonged and obstructed labor. It leaves women incontinent and without having control over their bladders. Urine can flow continuously, and because of this, many women are isolated and rejected from their communities. Australian Dr. Catherine Hamelin and her husband came to Ethiopia in 1959 to train midwives. They were faced with a fistula problem and noticed the lack of knowledge and treatment for this injury. The Hamelins developed and improved treatment technologies to help Ethiopian women. Their work has now resulted in a nomination for this year's Nobel Peace Prize. According to hospital director Martin Andrews, Dr. Hamelin's humble personality makes her not want to seek attention for herself. Andrews says that she is delighted with the recognition and hopes the nomination will create more awareness.
Her biggest concern is the lack of health professionals in rural Ethiopia, and anything that will raise awareness to that problem and try and bring a solution to that problem is what will really help.
Besides having set up 5 fistula clinics in Ethiopia, the Hamelin doctors have treated over 40,000 women and trained many nurses. Nurse Tenadu Bekele was selected in nursing school to come work at the fistula hospital and has been working there for 26 years. She says that Dr. Hamelin has been a great teacher and mentor for her.
Anyone can learn from her just by observing, just by following her, what she is doing. Her activity express what she wants to tell for other people to do for the others. So that's the way of her teaching.
While fistula was eradicated in the industrialized world in the 1920s, many developing countries still have thousands of women suffering from fistula. The Hamelin way of treating fistula is now being practiced all over the developing world. Every year, the hospital brings doctors from the developing world to Ethiopia to teach them about fistula treatments. The costs are mostly funded by private donations, but the hospital is free of charge for the patients. Fistula patient 30-year-old Amarech says she is happy with the care she has been receiving in the hospital. She says that if this hospital weren't here, her only choice would have been to stay at home until she would die. The winner of the Nobel Peace Prize will be announced this Friday. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
US-led coalition forces continue to attack Islamic State and other Islamist militants in Syria and Iraq. Some analysts say one of the key elements of beating it is to avoid making new enemies among warring parties and handing the group more allies. Heather Murdoch has more from Beirut.
One of the trickiest things for coalition forces fighting the Islamic State is determining which groups should be enemies and which should be allies. And it is allies, analysts say, that are important, not friends. Director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, Lina Khatib, says from the beginning, coalition forces made a mistake in targeting Al-Qaeda affiliate Al-Nusra along with the Islamic State. Khatib says the group could be a short-term coalition ally because it is also a long-time enemy of Islamic State militants. And while al-Nusra is technically also fighting the so-called moderate rebel groups, they do also have a relationship that Khatib calls backdoor connections. But for the West and in Lebanon, where al-Nusra forces continue to attack the borders, the idea of working with al-Nusra is impossible for the public to swallow, says the director of American Strategic Studies in Beirut, Kamal Wazni.
It's been identified as a terrorist organization, and it's part of the havoc that is taking place in the Middle East. We have to remember those people committed a lot of murder, a lot of destruction, a lot of car bombings, a lot of suicide attacks. So do we really trust them?
But as airstrikes continue and civilian casualty numbers mount, International Crisis Group Acting Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa, Robert Bletcher, says the coalition's options for friends on the ground will quickly diminish. During air campaigns in countries like Pakistan and Yemen, he says, new enemies were created every time a bomb hit a village or a wedding party.
Can anybody name a sustained air campaign that has not generated considerable civilian casualties in a way that complicated the mission? I can't think of any examples.
The complications, he mentions, could be considerable in Syria, which is already embroiled in a complex civil war. Besides anger over civilian deaths, coalition airstrikes are essentially boosting the government of President Bashar Assad. And the main enemy of the rebel groups the coalition is counting on for ground support is the Assad regime.
You're creating a situation where it's very difficult for the mainstream rebels to not come out against these strikes, and they end up getting pushed away from the main people, rebels end up getting pushed away from the mainstream groups toward the more radical groups. Because it looks like the U.S. is acting on behalf of the regime.
Bletcher says if they do not support the coalition, the mainstream rebel groups will most likely not back the extremists, but they will be on the same side. Establishing strong allies is also made difficult by long-term animosity among locals towards the West in Syria and Iraq, he says. To justify allying with the United States and the West, Bletcher says fighters ideologically opposed to Islamic State extremism will need concrete and sustained support. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Beirut.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, speaks to VOA on the Ebola crisis.
The people of the nation, the best thing that they can do is to try as best as possible to cooperate with the health authorities and to listen to and adhere to the suggestions and guidelines. We appreciate that this is something that is really awful to be going through. We're with you, we have solidarity with you, and hopefully we'll be able to end this terrible epidemic very soon.
That was Dr. Anthony Fauci, Director of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, speaking to VOA on the Ebola crisis.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. President Barack Obama announced increased screening procedures at 5 U.S. airports to identify any passengers entering the country with an Ebola infection. And residents of Central African Republic's capital stayed off the streets for a second day of renewed clashes between armed factions. Coming up, we have music from South Africa, and the International Monetary Fund says economic conditions remain difficult in Zimbabwe. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand African football once again topped your sports report.
Kim, let's kick off once again with African football. The next round of qualifying matches for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations tournament in Morocco begin Friday. There are three qualifiers on Friday and 11 on Saturday. This evening, we'll focus on Friday's fixtures. Lesotho will host Angola. Botswana is at home against Egypt. And Senegal will take on visiting Tunisia. Our African football guru, David Legg, says the matches in Botswana and Senegal are part of a very spicy Group G.
This, to me, is the really dynamic group this weekend. Botswana against Egypt and Senegal against Tunisia. Now, Egypt have won the Cup of Nations a record 7 times, but they failed to qualify in 2012 and 2013. And they're now facing the utter and complete humiliation of failing once again. They made a disastrous start. Not totally unexpected that they should lose to Senegal in Dakar, but they certainly would have expected more than a 1-goal loss at home to the Tunisians. And to cut a long story short, Sonny, if the Egyptians don't get maximum points in Gaborone on Friday, as far as I'm concerned, they've got no chance of making it to Morocco. Senegal and Tunisia, on the other hand, are two sides with 100% records, and one of those records obviously has to give away on Friday in Dakar when they meet. To me, at the moment, Senegal are among the most impressive teams in Africa. They play beautiful football, and you can see that they're being coached by that Frenchman, Alain Giresse. Wherever he's gone in Africa, he's produced very eye-pleasing football from his national teams. From an Egyptian perspective, they're probably hoping that both matches end in draws, but I feel that's unlikely. So, Sonny, for Egypt, very much D-Day weekend in that they must beat Botswana both at home and away. That would give them 6 points and would give them an outside chance of still making it to Morocco.
And what about the Lesotho-Angola match on Friday, David?
Lesotho and Angola meet each other in Maseru, and again, it's that cliché must win. Both teams making a disappointing start. Lesotho just 1 point, and Angola no points.
Still with the Nations Cup, David, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, recently announced the final list of bidding countries for the 2017 tournament. How about an update?
Yes, honey, the first surprise is there's so many. There actually are 7 countries bidding for the 2017 Cup of Nations, and in alphabetical order, they are Algeria, Egypt, Gabon, Ghana, Kenya, Sudan, and Zimbabwe. Now, of those 7, 5 are previous hosts of Nations Cups competitions. That's Algeria, Egypt, Gabon, Ghana, and Sudan. And interestingly, the other two countries, Kenya and Zimbabwe, both won the right to host the Nations Cup. But the Kenyans pulled out in 1996 because of financial problems, and they were replaced by South Africa. And Zimbabwe fell way behind schedule with their building program for the 2000 Nations Cup, and they had to be replaced by Ghana and Nigeria. And interestingly, Sunny, that was the very first co-hosted Africa Cup of Nations. Also interesting, I think, is that you've got two countries from East Africa, Kenya and Sudan. Now, just looking through my records, you've got to go back to 1976 and Ethiopia for the last time an East African nation hosted the Africa Cup of Nations. So, to put it mildly, they're long overdue a tournament, and I wonder if that will sort of work in favor. CAF have also stressed that they want basically a ready-made country. They want the facilities in place. They don't want building programs because of the time shortage. And I think, Sonny, that would favor the likes of Algeria, Egypt, Gabon, and Ghana. So it's going to be interesting. And, of course, Algeria, it remains that question. They bid for 219 and 221. They didn't get them. Did CAF deliberately not give those tournaments to Algeria because they believed that they would get 217? Or is the Albert Ebosse issue still rankling with the officials in CAF? Ebosse, of course, was that young Cameroonian footballer who died after being hit by a flying piece of slate during an Algerian league match. And they may just simply say, we cannot take our showpiece tournament to a country where this sort of thing happens. So the decision, Sonny, will be only made early next year at a meeting of the CAF Executive Committee. And after the surprises recently when Cameroon, Ivory Coast and Guinea got the 219, 221 and 223 Cup of Nations, it would be a very brave person who would predict just who's going to win this seven-way battle.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Let's give a sunny side of sports shout-out from my producer this evening, Bill Werkinger. Kick it, Bill!
Kick it!
I'm Shegu Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports, from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game!
Game on, VOA sports fans. Joining us now with more sports news is our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma in Johannesburg. And Mark begins with Kenya Athletics.
Athletics Kenya is in a race against time to secure the necessary government financial guarantees to save their bid to stage the 2017 IAAF World Youth Athletics Championships. The Athletics Kenya head, Isaiah Kiplagat, revealed in Nairobi on Wednesday. Kenya submitted their bid to stage the event within the deadline of the 25th of September. The World Athletics Governing Body, IAAF, has given Kenya until the end of October to submit documents confirming the Kenya government's financial backing. Kenya is vying with the United States of America and Canada to stage the event. Meanwhile, the cities of Barcelona in Spain, Doha in Qatar, and Eugene in the United States of America are official candidate cities to host the 2019 IAAF World Athletics Championships, the International Association of Athletics Federations revealed in Monaco. The World Athletics Governing Body says an evaluation commission will visit each city between the 14th and 31st of October. The IAAF will name the successful bid in Monaco on the 18th of November. In Taekwondo, hosts Rwanda dominated the Taekwondo Ambassadors Cup they hosted in Kigali. The event featured senior men and women's teams as well as boys and girls under 14 and under 17 age groups. Burundi were runners-up ahead of Kenya, the Democratic Republic of Congo and Uganda. In disability sports, Algeria will host the 2015 Gold Ball Africa Championships, the International Blind Sports Federation disclosed in Bonn, Germany. The event will feature a men's and women's competition from the 20th to the 30th of November next year, and it is a qualifier for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Paralympic Games in Brazil. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
My favorite basketball team, the Washington Wizards, will be shorthanded when they tip off their NBA regular season October 29th in Miami, Florida. Four Wizards, DeJuan Blair, Nene, Daniel Orton, and Xavier Silas, were suspended one game for leaving the bench area during an altercation between Washington's Paul Pierce and Chicago's Joakim Noah in a preseason game. The incident occurred early in the first quarter of Washington's 85-81 victory in Chicago. In addition, the NBA fined Noah and Pierce $15,000 each for their part in the basket brawl. Noah pushed Pierce in the chest while Pierce poked Noah in the forehead with his left index finger. The suspensions will apply to the first regular season game for which each player is eligible. The Brazilian Nene is a starter for the Wizards, while Blair is expected to be one of Washington's key reserve players. Orton and Silas, the two other suspended players, are also reserves and might not make Washington's final roster ahead of the regular season. Washington eliminated Chicago in the NBA playoffs last season, and after watching the teams go at it in that basket brawl in preseason, I can safely say they don't like each other. Finally, follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny. And my Twitter handle is at VOA Sunny Sports. I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sunny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the Mo Ibrahim Foundation's annual Index of Governance in Africa. And next, the International Monetary Fund and Zimbabwe's economic difficulties. But first, some music. Here is Big Nuz of South Africa with Ntombili.
Yes.
Sing out to my son and I.
Big news of South Africa with Ntemboli.
Well, the Mo Ibrahim Foundation has released its annual index of governance in Africa. The report shows continued small improvement continent-wide, although performance varied greatly from country to country. Here's VOA's Anita Powell in Johannesburg with the results.
This year's annual Mo Ibrahim African Governance Index came as something of an anticlimax. Many of the 52 nations maintained their spots from last year, with tiny Mauritius at the top and volatile Somalia at the bottom. The Charitable Foundation said it has moved back the date for awarding the $5 million African Leadership Prize in an attempt to keep attention focused on the index instead of on the lucrative award. This year's index, released Monday, reveals that in the past 5 years, the continent's overall governance has improved only slightly, with an average improvement of less than 1 point out of a maximum score of 100. Mo Ibrahim Index of African Governance Director Liz McGraw points out some highlights of the report.
So we've seen that at the continental level, the Ibrahim Index shows that overall governance has slightly improved over the past 5 years. But this rate of improvement has been slower than in the previous five-year period. And we've also seen that the drivers of governance improvement on the continent have changed over the past 10 years. So whereas sustainable economic opportunity was the main driver between 2005 and 2009, since 2009, overall governance has been driven by participation in human rights and human development.
The index ranks countries based on human development, safety and rule of law, human rights, and sustainable economic opportunity. The rankings show an overall continental improvement in health indices, despite a raging Ebola outbreak in West Africa. The data for this year's report were collected before the first mass Ebola outbreaks were reported. But McGraw says the index measures health through many variables, which include maternal health, immunizations, nourishment, and sanitation.
These indicators aren't necessarily direct proxies for a crisis like Ebola. So it's important just to basically look at the fact that these things are improving on the continent. These measures are definitely, perhaps in large part due to the Millennium Development Goals, getting better in Africa.
After Mauritius, Cape Verde, Botswana, South Africa, and Seychelles round out the top five. Some traditionally low-ranked countries, among them Guinea, Zimbabwe, and Chad, have made large strides in the past year, although not enough to lift them high in the rankings. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The International Monetary Fund says economic conditions remain difficult in Zimbabwe as growth has slowed down because of inadequate financial flaws. In a statement, an IMF mission under the Staff Monitor Program says the decline in growth is being worsened by the appreciation of the South African rand. It says this has caused a liquidity crunch that has weakened economic activity despite what it calls a very favorable agricultural season. The IMF further says the country has, however, redoubled its efforts to rebalance policies towards a stable macroeconomic environment conducive to private sector-led growth. The Bretton Woods Institution says Zimbabwe needs to restore confidence and stability in the country's financial sector and address its $10 billion debt by stepping up re-engagement with all creditors. The team met recently with Finance Minister Patrick Chinmasa and other finance officials. Economic commentator Masimba Kuchera of the Center for Disability and Development tells reporter Gibbs Dube the IMF has made commendable observations in Zimbabwe.
If anything, the economic situation has become worse. Actually, in addition to that, I also think that it's not only the South African rand that has affected our economy. I think there are also issues to do with the local governance that have also affected the economy.
Now then, there is a report which indicates that Information Minister Jonathan Moy is saying the situation on the ground in Zimbabwe is actually improving. Do you agree with that kind of outlook from the minister?
When you look at people's lot, it hasn't improved. Companies are closing down. The government is failing to either increase wages or to even pay the wages that they owe on time. And some of the payments to workers are not happening. So I think that because of that, when you look at those, some of those factors, you may think that the economy is improving, but maybe there are things behind the scenes that are happening which we are not aware of, which could impact positively in the end on the economy.
So in a way, are you saying that the minister is actually right to say there is some kind of improvement?
I am saying that the minister could have looked at other factors that we are not privy to, in the same way that the IMF has also said that Zimbabwe has achieved macroeconomic stability. I think when you look at price fluctuations and so on and so forth, that may be true. But the ordinary citizen on the ground has not yet started benefiting from the so-called improvement.
That was economic commentator Masimba Kuchera of the Center of Disability and Development speaking with reporter Gibbs Dube. The government says the country is currently showing signs of economic growth. However, that's contrary to statements by Finance Ministry, which paints a bleak picture of the economy. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Joseph Simkovich, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Rape is often used as a tactic of war, intentionally terrorizing and brutalizing entire communities. And although women and girls are by far the most common victims, men and boys are also frequently assaulted. Given that the legacy of sexual violence and conflict can cause long-term instability, addressing impunity is part of the process for restoring peace. The scourge of sexual violence in conflict has been identified by the United Nations as a matter of acute and urgent concern, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Samantha Power. Neither the fog of war nor the associated breakdown of law provide any explanation or excuse for actions that violate the rights and disrespect the fundamental dignity of human beings. Working through the United Nations Security Council, the international community has repeatedly stated that sexual violence will not be tolerated. But much more needs to be done if we are to stamp out such criminal behavior. Where sexual violence occurs because the government is weak, the international community must do more to help local institutions develop responses, including access to justice and support for survivors. That's because governments have a duty to protect and promote the rights of citizens. Every government should have or establish laws, develop institutions, and pursue policies that protect from sexual violence all of its people, regardless of gender, social, or economic status. It is very important that every government take steps to ensure that the stigma of sexual violence no longer bedevils the survivors, including male survivors, as is too often the case. Instead, it is time to affirm that guilt and stigma fall on the shoulders of the perpetrators. In far too many countries, the victims of sexual violence still have little, if any, effective legal recourse. Until that changes, predators will not be deterred, survivors will hesitate to come forward, and justice will remain beyond reach, said Ambassador Power. Sexual abuse is inflicted out of cruelty and robs people of the right to life, liberty, and security of person. Still, for far too long, it has been treated as part of the spoils of victory. That must end. The government and the people of the United States strongly support a concerted strategy across the globe to address this scourge, both in peace and war.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Here's advice from the international medical group Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, to help limit the spread of the Ebola virus. First, do not touch or eat the bushmeat of animals from the forest. Avoid contact with blood, urine, feces, vomit, sweat, tears, saliva, mucus, or genital secretions of an Ebola patient. Do not handle the bodies of the patients who have died of Ebola. Inform the nearest health center of any suspected Ebola cases. Seek health care immediately, because infected people have a much higher survival rate if they receive early treatment at a health facility, compared to staying home. These are recommendations from the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, on how to prevent the spread of Ebola.